So here's a little picture of some of the recent results we did, and some arrows that will connect them and maybe help them make a little more sense in your mind. Because we had a lot of these results where we started with or ended with a graph. And I mean this as a graph as abstractly. So just, you know, think of this as just vertices and edges, a set of vertices and a set of pairs of vertices. It's just not necessarily drawn. And then we had usually some straight line embeddings, which is really you could think of as just a place to draw the points. I'm going to put in parentheses because really what I care about is points in the plane. And if you think about starting from points and going to graphs, that one, do it clockwise, was the method par excellence that we did here was the Deligne triangulation. That was kind of our main, or at least the most important way we took points and came up with a graph. We know other ways. You saw in your homework the Gabriel graph right here, Deligne. And we also go the other way, of course. If you just have a graph, we did see how to get straight line embeddings. And that was Tutt's algorithm. And if you dig into these only just one layer further, you'll see that, well, to get this Deligne triangulation, we went from the points, we actually kind of branched off here to a lifting of the points. Right? We lift them off the paraboloid, and then you got the graph. And to get from the graph to the embedding via Tutt's algorithm, well, we had the graph, and then we put a stress on it. And then we got our embedding, where the stress was, what, -1 everywhere? At least, certainly on the interior edges. The outer edges, we just locked down. And then we talked a little bit about this Maxwell-Cremona correspondence, which allows us to go back and forth here. So this is the MCC, the Maxwell-Cremona correspondence. Nice classic of 19th century. Pretty nice, huh? Does it all make more sense now? We'll get it deeply. All right, well, here's something you can do now. If you have a graph, in fact, we did something like this. We took a graph, and we went up. What did we do? We said, well, let's put a stress on the graph, Tutt's algorithm. And we actually saw that turned it into a lifting. And from here, this path from a graph to a lifting gave us at least one half of our proof of Stein's theorem. Right? Because it said there was, if you put a non-negative stress, you'll get a convex lifting. And so that was, if the outer face was right, that gave us Stein's theorem, and we had to do some stuff around the outer face. This is where we checked to see if the graph had a triangle. We used the triangle as the outer face. And if the graph didn't have a triangle, its dual had a triangle. We did that first. Okay, so that's one thing you can do. You can also just, this is what you might call lifting a Tutt embedding. So in the Maxwell-Cremona correspondence, right, the reason that this worked for us, the reason we were able to get this lifting to be convex, is because there was this relationship between the sign of the stress and the way the edges bend when lifting. So in the plane, I could have two triangles like this, and when I lift them up, if this stress is negative, when I lift it, it's going to be what we call a valley. So negative stresses give valleys, and positive stresses, so when I would, if I instead looked at the top here, corresponds to the edge here, instead if I flip this and use the same lifting, right, this red is what I get if I flip this one edge, if I use the same height function on the vertices, I lifted them to the same height, And then what I would get, of course, flipping these triangles, it bends the other way. So that's a positive, that would correspond to a positive stress. I'm going to call it a mountain or a ridge. Now, if you have all negative stresses, then they all bend up. And so it's everywhere locally, technically, I guess we would usually call this concave. But the lower convex hull is exactly what we lifted. And so we're going to explore this idea of looking at the lower convex hull of lifting just a little bit more. So it turns out it connects to a bunch of different areas in computational geometry, and I'll pick an assortment of them to show you. Any questions? It's all clear, easy, good stuff? So the first way to generalize this picture over here using this intuition is what's called the weighted Delaunay triangulation. In a way, we already laid the foundation for doing this when we talked about how the Voronoi diagram was what? It was the upper envelope of the planes, which were dual to the lifted points. And since that duality didn't require those points to be on the paraboloid, I could have lifted those points anywhere and I would get different planes. And so, just by going through the same duality process, I'll get not just a weighted Delaunay triangulation, but a weighted Voronoi diagram. Let me give you the definition first, though. So we're going to have weighted points. And what this means is that for every point of a point P and a weight, we'll call it WP. And WP is just a real number. Debate on how to do this. For now, just pretend all these are all positive real numbers. And we have a lifting function, and the lift is going to take a point P, and it's going to map it up into 3D. So this is a point P in R2, and using our usual convention, where this is going to be the first two coordinates on the first two coordinates of P, and now we're going to lift it up to be P squared minus, I always debate on what's the best way to do this. For now, let's say it's this square. Makes the math just a little cleaner. So this is a point in 3D, and you'll notice immediately that if all the points have weight 0, this is the usual parabolic lifting. If all the weights are 0, this is just taking a point, giving it a third coordinate, which is its squared norm. It's lifting it straight up onto the unit parabola. Standard z equals x squared plus y squared parabola. Okay, so that's going to be our lift. And now I'm just going to define the weighted Delaunay triangulation. In fact, I'm not going to call it the triangulation at first. Let's just call it the weighted Delaunay diagram. It's going to be the projection of the lower convex hull after lifting. Okay, so this having a weight gives us adjust the lift, and you can see why you can think of weights as being like a little bit like physical weights. I lifted them up onto the paraboloid, and I pulled them down a bit based on their weight. Technically, I brought it down by the square of their weight. And if you remember how this duality worked, if this is my paraboloid, in fact, let's just take a two-dimensional slice, so the picture in the plane really is the picture. If I have a point, say this was the point lifted onto the paraboloid, and I brought it down. And this is, this here is, say, the weight squared. And this is the point lifted, which I'll just call P plus. Because the original point was down here in the plane. And the dual of this lifted point is going to be a plane, or it's going to be a plane which is has the same gradient as a as the tangent to the paraboloid here, but it's going to be passed through a point which is the same distance. So I'm going to go straight up some more, another WP squared. I'm going to take this point, and I'm going to take this is, if this is the tangent, I'm going to take a plane parallel to that tangent to this point. So that's how we do duality, and that's the relationship. Remember that. So this distance from the paraboloid just tells you how much you would move if you move the point down some amount to get this weighted version. You would move the plane up the same amount to get the weighted dual. And so when the weight is zero, they both pass through this point. But as the weight goes up, they sort of start spreading out.
And what do you call the plane that that goes through the weighted point?
The plane that goes through the weighted point.
Yeah.
Well, the weighted point is down here. It's been lifted to here. And what plane? There's no
the red one.
This one up here is the dual to the P plus. So it's the dual to the lifted point. And it's the same projective dual we've been using.
And the red line is the dual to P plus?
Yes.
So the lift shouldn't be like, instead of P, it's P plus?
Yes, this notation, this is pretty standard mathematical notation for the point P itself gets mapped to this.
Okay.
So if I gave this function a name, if I called it H, for example, I would write it as, I would write H, and I'd replace this with an equals. But it's just a notation for introducing functions without naming them. All right. So that's how we do duality, and so once we have duality in here, if I'm going to project the lower hull, I might as well take the dual and also project the upper envelope. And that would be what we call our weighted Voronoi. Okay, so it's projection of the upper envelope. Remember, the upper envelope is just a polyhedron, just the intersection of the half spaces, where each half space is bounded by a plane dual to one of the lifted points, and it's just the half space above. So it's at least well defined. It's clear that it at least exists. And let's just try to work out some little examples to figure out what it looks like, what's really happening. The first thing to notice is that if I have this point P and I gave it some weight, and let's say I had another point Q over here, and Q, say, has weight zero, just to make it easy to us. So the plane dual to Q, the lifted Q, is this one. And there's a couple things we know. So if I looked at the this intersection, this is the intersection of the plane dual to P with weight zero, because it's actually lifted straight onto the paraboloid. And here's the plane dual to lifted Q. We know that their intersection would project right back down onto the midpoint. Because this is how we found, in fact, perpendicular bisectors. That you just lift these planes and you find that the two planes intersect in a line, and that line projects to the perpendicular bisector. But what happened is we added some weight to P, which moved the dual up, which moved the intersection to the right here. as a color. So if we think about this as a Voronoi cell, adding weight to P has caused the Voronoi cell to grow. It's sort of claiming more space. And we'll give another alternative definition of a weighted Voronoi diagram, which is what it's going to do is it's going to change how we measure distances. This is a pretty useful idea.
Using the weighted Voronoi diagram, using different metrics for every point, or
It's technically not a metric. It is a kind of distance, and it is like changing a distance for every point. Yeah, and we're going to show exactly what that function is. In fact, it'll fall out pretty quickly once we try to figure out what our new version of a perpendicular bisector is after we've introduced some weights. So what we have is a weighted point. Let's call it PWP. Here's a point. And we lifted it to this point P, like the P squared minus WP squared. Often they don't square this. You'll see why it's sometimes better without it, sometimes better. Also, you'll see it doesn't actually matter. And we take that and we're going to dualize it. So this was our lift. This was our dual. And this gave us a plane. And that plane had an equation, which was just the set of all x, y, z, such that z is equal to 2. P transpose xy minus this, so it's minus p squared minus the p. So the plane is just all x, y, z that satisfy this equation. You recognize this, remember this?
Which plane is that?
This is the plane dual to this lifted point. So this is the red, the first red one I drew.
Okay. So how come is that? The first one.
Yeah, so if you just differentiate this, you see what's the gradient. This is a constant term. You're going to get just 2p here. And that's exactly the gradient of the paraboloid at that point. Because the paraboloid is z equals x squared plus y squared. Right, so the gradient of this is 2x plus 2y, or just 2x, 2y. So that's where the 2 comes in, 2 times this, and it's just the linear function.
So why did you put a minus there? Like after the metric minus of the constant of?
Right, because that's how we defined our projected dual, so that above and below continue to mean above and below.
So above is always for the...
In general, this is how we did our projected duality. We said that if you have a point, you have points P and then PD, whatever the d-dimensional coordinate is, this will map to the plane that's the d-dimensional version, but it's the same here, right? So if you have a point x, it's a set of all points x, xd, that's what this equals. So that we had to do this, we did this minusing over here so that not only were incidences preserved, but above and below, still not above and below. If you don't do that, you just have to change the words, when you do the duality, you have to say above becomes below and below becomes above. It's
hard. If you didn't flip it above the paraboloid, it wouldn't. The lower hole wouldn't be necessarily convex, right?
The lower hull is always going to be convex.
Really?
Oh. You might not, but it might be weird things. Other weird things could happen. Like you could have a point which doesn't appear in the lower hull. That's called. We sometimes call that.
Buried. I got yours. Okay, that's what I meant.
Yeah. So that's
like it. It could be like this.
Yeah. No. It doesn't actually go.
No, the planes couldn't be like
that. The point just disappears.
The planes couldn't be like.
You're just going to forget about that point that's buried. So we'll go through some of these kind of funny examples, and you'll see that you have to kind of expand what your idea of what a triangulation is. Or that's also why I use the word diagram here, not triangulation, because there are going to be degeneracies that we're not even going to want to avoid at first. All right, so this is just the setup, and if we ask this simple question, what is the, I'm going to put in quotes here, the bisector between two weighted points, PWP and QWQ. Okay, so we're just going to take those points, lift them off the planes, and we're going to see where those planes intersect, and then we're just going to project it back down. So it should be the set of points in the plane such that 2p transpose xy minus this whole thing, squared minus wp, is equal to 2q transpose xy minus like q squared minus wq. And we'll just use one little identity here. You may recall that if I took p minus xy and I took its squared norm, that would be equal to the squared norm of p minus 2p transpose xy plus the norm squared of xy. Keep this as an aside. This, together with this, if you notice, I have these two terms in common. I have the negative of this. So if this is true, and this is going to be true, of course, also for the distance, the squared distance between q and xy is going to give us with q here. And so if I plug in this identity, this norm squared of xy will cancel out, and all I get is that the distance from p to xy squared minus wp squared is equal to the distance from q to xy squared minus wq squared. So that's just algebra. I know it's a lot of small space. I think you could work through that without too much difficulty. And if you look at this term right here, we're going to give this a name for now. I'm going to call this little pi sub p of xy. So this is now a function that depends on p, but for any point in the plane, it's going to give us the distance, the square distance from that point to p, minus the square weight of p. And similarly, I'm going to get this over here, which I'm going to call little pi q of xy. All right, so the set of points for which these two things are equal are going to give us the bisector. So what do these things mean? Let's just look at, in fact, it comes right down to, the Pythagorean theorem. So if this is our point P, and this is a ball of radius WP, and I have some point out here which we've been calling XY, although, in fact, these kind of definitions don't really depend on it being two-dimensional. This was just our new point. For those of you who like to follow along these lectures, imagining that everything is in D dimensions, this is one where everything will work. Otherwise, you're fine. It's okay to just think of it as 2D. What are we looking for? We're looking for a distance. Pi P of xy is a distance such that... the distance squared here minus this squared distance is equal to pi p squared. So we know that that is going to be exactly the right triangle here. This is wp squared. Maybe I need to square it. Nope, that's okay. Right, this distance is WP. This distance is P minus XY. So this squared plus this squared equals this squared. And so this right here is, this distance, I guess, is the square root of pi P of XY. So sometimes we also just square this. We say that pi p is defined to be the square root of this number, so that this comes out to be the usual distance in the case where the weights are zero. Like I said, it doesn't really matter just for aesthetics and writing the math. So that's this. Instead of measuring our distance here from the points to the input points, we're measuring it sort of the distance to a line, to a point tangent to some circle. So instead of thinking about these weighted points as just points with a weight, you could think of them as disks. Yeah.
So in pi p xy, we have the weight is, we subtract the weight squared. Is that really what we expect over here?
Yeah, so if I go from this squared minus this squared is equal to this squared. And this squared minus this squared was equal to pi p of xy.
Okay.
That's why it's this distance squared minus p squared. So distance squared minus p squared. Good, so Pythagorean theorem tells us that what we're kind of measuring, and so we can see how a little bit how the bisectors will move as you increase or decrease the weights of points. So here's two points with weights. As I increase the weight here, I'm going to move the bisector. I don't know exactly where it's going to be, but we know that for every point here, the distance to a point tangent to one circle is the same as the distance to a tangent point on the other circle. So that's our new criterion. And if I define it directly as this, it might not be so obvious that you get a line. So if I just gave you disks, actually the first, maybe seemingly more natural definition would be to say, well, just ask which is closest, which point in the plane is equidistant from both disks, instead of worrying about all this tangent nonsense. But if you do that, you won't get nice straight lines. You'll get these, actually, you'll get hyperbolas. And in 3D, it's even worse. But since we constructed it directly as the projection of a polyhedron, we know we're going to get straight lines. So that's kind of we pay for some slight, perhaps slightly more awkward definition of distance down here. But the advantage is that you really get a nice piecewise linear structure. Okay, And we can define now the Voronoi diagram in analogy with the classic Voronoi diagram. So a weighted Voronoi cell Voronoi P of a point Q, this is big P for the weighted point set, is equal to the set of all X in the plane such that pi Q of X is less than or equal to pi Y of X for all Y in this is exactly the same, this looks exactly like the original definition we had of Voronoi cells, except that instead of looking at pi q of x, we would look at just the Euclidean distance from q to x. And there is this difference that this seems to be a squared distance. Like if the weights are zero, that gives you the squared distance. But that's actually more natural for computation anyway, as we saw, right? If you want to compare two distances, you might as well compare the square distances and avoid computing square roots because the squaring function is monotone. Right, so you can check that as all the weights go to zero, this Voronoi diagram is the same as the Voronoi diagram you all come to know. Questions on this?
The only condition for the separated Voronoi is just there are multiple lines perpendicular to the device, perpendicular to the circles.
Mm-hmm. They're the same length from the same point. Because there's always two perpendiculars, and they're actually always the same length. And there's always two from any point to a disk. I can always draw two tangent lines. And if I look at just the segment where from the point where it first touches that disk to the point of tangency, those are the same length. Because it's a nice isosceles triangle. So given this picture, which I'll leave up, what can we say about some of these other structures in terms of, in the language of, weighted Dewine triangulation? One of the first is top embeddings are weighted Dewine diagrams. So since taking this red path here, since when we take a graph, put a stress on it, fix the outer face, Salatut's algorithm, and since the stresses are all negative, Maxwell's coronal correspondence says it really is a lower convex hull. Well, we know it. I should be careful. What we saw was that every edge is a valley, and you need to check that sets that are everywhere locally convex are globally convex. So the fact that the edges all bend the right way is good, and the fact that it projects, that really does project down into the convex hull of the point set is enough, right? We saw the same thing even in the case of one-dimensional curves, piecewise linear curves, when we did gram scare. We have to see that way. If you always turn the same way and you don't wind on yourself, then you're convex polygonal. And same is true for convex polygonal strong 3. So we get that the top embeddings are weighted Dewine diagrams. And here is almost immediately you see why it's nicer to say diagram, because we could start with a graph that wasn't a triangulation. And we know that the top embeddings give us an embedding of that graph, and it had this special property that all the faces were nice convex pieces. And part of the reason, we actually proved that they were convex pieces by locally checking that they were convex. But if you also understand it in terms of a lifting via the Maxwell-Kronig correspondence, you know they're convex because they're projections of faces of a convex polytope. Right, so if you have a convex polyhedron, its faces are convex polyhedra, and the linear projection of a convex set is still convex. Okay, so tut is an example of a weighted Galois triangulation. And I should note, if you're ever trying to Google this, there's other words that are used for the same concept. So there's also the term irregular triangulation. I think I'm not sure if it was in topology or algebraic geometry when these were rediscovered, they were sometimes called coherent triangulations. And as I said, often they're not triangulations. And even in the case of plain vanilla, no weights, Delaunay triangulation, we saw that sometimes you would get faces which weren't triangles. When would you get a face that wasn't a triangle? And do you remember? When would you get a quadrilateral face?
Oh.
Can you remember?
Points are in a square.
If they're on a square, yes. It's actually, there's other cases as well. Does anyone know any other cases?
Co-circular,
right. Anytime they're co-circular. Right, and why is that? So if their points are co-spherical, co-circular, and you lift them onto a paraboloid, then they're coplanar. So what does that mean in terms of the bend in those edges? Let's just take quadrilateral. If I had one of these edges, but I lifted them up to be coplanar, then that edge, it's not a valley or a ridge. It's flat. It would be a zero stress, in fact. And so in the projection, it's actually not an edge at all. So we've seen, so we at least have kind of, we saw, we knew they existed, we pretended they didn't, but now when we start talking about tut embeddings, well, you know you can get a tut embedding of a graph. You can get something that's basically a Voronoi diagram, take a graph of it and say, give me the tut embedding of that. And you obviously don't expect the Voronoi diagram to be a triangulation. I don't think it's ever a triangle, is it? You have to be a very degenerate point set. Maybe a hexagonal lattice gives you dualized into a triangle. Okay, so that's fine. We get some, at least one of our classic structures, it falls into this category. And so anytime we take a lifting, take the lower hull and project it, you're going to get a weighted Delaunay triangulation. There's another really famous one, which I'll mention. Fortunately, we won't have time to prove it. It really exists. But there's something called a Kobe embedding. So given a planar graph, and let's just pretend for now that we do have a triangulation. So the graph is a triangulation of a polygon. And I want to draw that graph in a very special way. I want to assign radii to the vertices, which is something that should be already familiar to us now, so that when I draw the points with their radii as disks, should get another color here, that the edges are exact, or that all of the disks are interior disjoint, and they touch you. This is sometimes called kissing disks. They are tangent to each other exactly if there's an edge. So this is a Kobe embedding of this particular graph. Okay, again, it's not obvious that this exists. If I just gave you a graph, a planar graph, and said, find me a Kobe embedding of that graph, then the problem is to figure out where to put the points and what should the weights be, what should the radii be, so that there's an edge if and only if the discs kiss. So you can guess immediately that if I wanted to view this triangulation as a weighted De Lorne triangulation, what am I going to do? I'm going to set the weights to be the radii, assuming someone actually gave me one of these. I'm going to set the weights to be the radii, and now, let's see if I can draw it, I'm going to have the weight, this is the I knew the square was going to get me in trouble. So you may have noticed that some things start to get a little funny if I have negative weights because of the square. And I really would like to be able to take any height function and take its lower hull. And so if I just called the replaced the weights here with the square of their weights, and I didn't square it here, if I got rid of all these squares everywhere, then I could set weights positive or negative. And the difference would be just what you think. Instead of having a negative weight instead of being below the paraboloid, would be above the paraboloid. And I kind of want to do that here because this particular point, if I give it a weight of a negative weight to pull it up here, then I look at the I take it back. All right. You can do this either way. Pretend instead that this is the plane dual. I gave it a positive weight as before, so I pulled this point down by some weight. Here was the point lifted onto the paraboloid, and this is the plane dual to that lifted point. And we know it intersects in a disc, and it should intersect in exactly this disc. So this is one of the points P. We know it intersects in this, well, it actually intersects in an ellipse, which projects to the disk. Right, and there's a special property here, this kissing property. What that looks like up here is that if I look at two of these ellipses, so here's P, here's Q. So this is the disk corresponding to Q. It's just the dual intersecting the paraboloid. Then I see that these planes intersect exactly at this point. And this point is on the paraboloid. So we know that, in fact, this dual edge from P to Q, it's almost impossible to draw. Technically, it went through that intersection point. And the reason is the incidence preservation of projective duality. This is a point which is in the intersection of the two dual planes. So the line set between the two primal points intersects the line of intersection between the two dual points. So if there is, it turns out that the Kobe embedding, if you do this lifting, it's a unique and kind of special weighted De Lorne triangulation, which happens to have this property that every single one of the edges lifts to a line segment tangent to the paraboloid. See, because it intersects right here on the paraboloid. So it's just a particularly nice special case of weighted De Lorne where the edges are sort of forced to be tangent to the paraboloid. So if you go back and you think to when we originally did flips. When we first introduced the De Lorne triangulation, we had this flip algorithm, where you're just going to flip edges if they're not locally De Lorne until you get to something that's De Lorne. An important thing we needed there was that you could, as long as you keep doing these flips, you'll eventually get to the De Lorne triangulation. And that was the first taste of something what you might call, which is sometimes called a configuration space. So there was a whole bunch of possible triangulations. And flips gave us a way of going from one triangulation to another. So we had a way to navigate this space of triangulations. And now I claim with liftings and weighted Dohnanyi triangulation, we're going to get another way to navigate that space, or at least a subset of that space. We're going to be able to navigate this subset of just the regular or weighted Dohnanyi triangulations. And we're going to see that that space has a very, very nice structure. Okay, but in order to do that, you have to think back to when we first did flips. One of the ways we argued that the flip algorithm would terminate was that every time we did a flip, we decreased the volume beneath the lifting. That every time we flip from something, from a ridge to a valley, that we were decreasing the volume. So if I give you a triangulation, and I give you a lifting, how do you compute the volume? Anyone knows? Think about it while I write it down. So I give you a lifting, so I have height function from the vertices to the reals. And for now, we're always going to have n vertices. So we'll say v is equal to v1 to vn. And I'm going to think about h as a vector in Rn. Instead of thinking of it as a function, I'm going to say h, I'm going to view h as an Rn and say, I can call it h naught, where h sub I is just equal to h0 of vertex vi. Okay, so the vector of heights, once I've numbered the vertices, and I'm going to give you that, and I'm going to give you a triangulation. So, given a triangulation T, and it's a drawn triangulation, so we also have the locations of the points on the point set, as I already called it, V. Our goal is to find the volume underneath the lift. So here was you have the triangulation down here. I have the lifting. Let's make it a little more complicated. Lifting out of color. So how do you do it? Determinant in this case, something easier. So here's a volume. I want to compute its volume. I have a natural way to break it up into nice, pretty well-behaved pieces. Right? So in fact, the volume underneath lifting decomposes into these nice little prism-type shapes. There's a triangle on top, a triangle on the bottom. In fact, they all look something like this. Some triangle. Okay, and what's the volume of this? What's the area of the base times?
Average all those heights.
Times what?
Can you average all those heights?
The average of the heights. Anyone know that? Yeah, so it's the average of the heights times, so if I had just this one triangle, and I have the area of this triangle was A, and I have height h1, h2, h3, then for this, the volume is equal to A times h1 plus h2 plus h3 over 3. It's the average of the heights. So now I can just do that for every prism, But there's another kind of acute way of computing this, which is, it goes like this. So if I take, for each vertex, I'm going to take, I'm going to say the area of all the triangles that touch that vertex, say VI, is, I'm going to call it AI. So for each VI and V, let AI equal the area of triangles containing VI. Now I claim that the volume underneath this is just 1/3 A transpose H, just the dot product of them. Do you believe that? Surprising? So as you might guess, the 1/3 is sort of coming from this, but this was just coming from averaging. If in the case of just one triangle, let's check this formula in the case of just one triangle. If there's only one triangle, then A1 is equal to A, because there's only one triangle touching that vertex. A2 is equal to A, and A3 is equal to A. So I just have A times each of these. And then I took 1/3. Why did I take 1/3? Well, one way to think of it is I averaged, or you could say I counted each one, right? This triangle's area got computed from the perspective of P1, from the perspective of P2, and the perspective of P3. And so I counted it 3 times and I took their average. So everybody kind of voted on what they thought the area contribution of that one triangle is, and then we took the average. In fact, if you do that everywhere, you just get that the total volume of the lifting is 1/3 A transpose H. So this should jump out at you. This is cool because this is, we now have liftings as just vectors in some space. We took our triangulations and we turned them into vectors in Rn. And now finding the triangulation that minimizes the volume beneath it, which is the volume, the triangulation which is the projection of the lower hull, is just optimizing a linear function. This is linear programming. That's somehow we turned this question of finding the best triangulation for a given lifting and turned it into linear programming. Who studied some linear programming before? Who's heard of linear programming before? You heard of it. You know you're supposed to know it. You know that it's some huge fraction of all the major computations that go out in the world. One form or another. If it's not linear algebra, then it's linear programming. Linear programming seeks to solve almost precisely this kind of question. First, it says you have some objective function that, say, you want to minimize. So I want to find, in this case, I want to find a given area vector that minimizes this height function, and that minimizes the volume given a particular height function. So I've lifted the points up, and I want to find the triangulation, which minimizes this volume. But of course, I'm constrained, right? I'm constrained. What am I constrained to? I'm only allowed to pick real triangulations. I can't just pick anything from my areas and say, well, this point gets no area. And this point, oh, no area. The next point, no area. Look, I got zero. It may seem like a win, but I can't. I have to actually constrain myself to only pick real triangulations. And the way I can do that is I can take the space of all triangulations. So for every triangulation, I can get a height function or a height vector, h. So for each triangulation, I'm sorry, not a height function, an area vector, right? Because if I have a triangulation, it's in the plane, points are fixed, I can just compute the areas and I get some vector. So anytime you give me a triangulation of the point set, I'll give you a vector A, which is the area vector. And now, among all of those, of all those points in Rn now, and there's a lot of these, for a given point set, there's a huge number of triangulations, but among all of those, if you give me, given some height function, we can find the triangulation to minimize this volume. Okay, it doesn't look like linear programming because there's no convexity structure here, right? In fact, two of these are linear constraints. The way we can turn it into one, though, is we take all these points, we get this set of points for every triangulation, where every point corresponds to a triangulation, and we take their convex hull. We take the convex closure of all those triangulations. Now, this should stretch your brain a little bit, because now we're talking about, we took a space of triangulations, and now we're doing our usual geometric operations to it. We're taking convex closure of the set of abstract points in Rn, where the points happen to correspond to triangulations. But there's something that we know. We know that if one of those points does minimize some height function, then it's a regular triangulation. Right? It has to be a lower hull. So for a given height function, you know the lower hull is going to minimize the volume. So the only points on the outside of this convex hull, on the convex hull of this set of points, AT here, I look for... the only points on the convex hull are the regular triangulations. Okay, well, why should we look at it as a polytope? This is called the secondary polytope. Triangulations of points at P. Well, we know what the vertices are now. The vertices have to be the regular triangulation. What are the edges? The simplest kind of linear programming problem you can imagine is a two-dimensional case where you have some polyhedron. Linear programming says you have some direction that you want to optimize, so you want to maximize or minimize in this direction, and you're looking for the point on the inside or on this in this polytope that's farthest in that direction. So if I would go orthogonal in that direction, get to this point. Okay. That's the optimization in linear optimization.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is always a vertex. If I have a polytope.
Is it always a vertex?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. Is it, in 2D, in this case, is there any direction where the optimum is not a vertex? What's that?
No.
Well, it's true that there's always an optimum that is a vertex, but it might not be unique. So when is it not unique? Well, if I'm looking at a direction orthogonal to one of the edges, then the entire edge is optimal. It's somehow degenerate, but it is the case that the edge now is a case where both of these are optimal. Now, in the case of triangulations, that means you have two triangulations where the volume beneath them is the same. And generically, that can only happen if those two triangulations differ by exactly one foot. Because if you want to have the, if you perturb the height function a little bit, that's like perturbing this direction a little bit. Because this direction is the height function. right? The objective is a vector, and I'm just going to, if I want to find how far a point is in a particular direction, I just take the dot product with that a vector in that direction. So if I perturb the height function, but I find I get this whole space of perturbations where two triangulations come out with the same volume, it has to be a minimal situation in which minimal degeneracy. So in the case of triangulations in the plane, it means it must be just four points are coplanar in the lifting. So if four points are coplanar in the lifting, for height functions like this, that means if I go a little bit one way, let's draw these four points, there's two situations I could be in. They're flat up here. If I perturb it a little one way, I'm going to end up with this triangulation. If I perturb it a little the other way, I'm going to get the other triangulation. So now I have this very high-dimensional polytope where the vertices are regular triangulations, and by walking along the edges from edge to edge, it's just doing flips. So it actually represents a subset of the so-called flip graph, which is the graph you get by on the space of triangulations by connecting triangulations that differ by one flip. Well, okay, I left something out here. This is one case, but there's another case which we mentioned and we saw it in the case of incremental Dewani, and that's if we had the four points like this, right, where this has to flip to the case where in the lower hull, one of the points disappeared. So I was looking at the lower hull, but one point was too high. It actually was buried on the inside. This is called flipping out a point if you're going this way. It's called flipping in a point if you go the other way. We also call it the three-way split if you did it in your homework. So the incremental Dewani triangulation algorithm, if you thought about it as first we do this flip thing and then we do flips, you could have also thought of it as first we do this one kind of flip, but now we're going to do other kinds of flips. And so these are all flips. In fact, you're going to have to consider these kind of triangulations as well in this space. Okay. So that's just one of my favorite little topics here, where you can describe this space of triangulation. So here's an open problem, a wonderful little open problem. In 2D, we saw you take any triangulation and you can flip it to Dewani. And since you could reverse that set of flips, you could flip from any one triangulation to any other triangulation. Because all you have to do is you flip your way to Dewani and then reverse your flips to the other triangulation. And that gives you a path of flips. In 3D, we don't know if this is true. If I give you a set of points in 3D, and I limit you only to doing what counts as a 3D flip, it's going to be where you have 5 points now. You have 5 points which were coplanar, say, in the lifting. Or you don't even need a lifting. You just take 5 points, you take their convex hull, and those 5 points are the projection of a four-dimensional simplex. Okay, so if you have 5 points in R3, you can think of it as the projection of either the top or the bottom of a four-dimensional simplex. Switching between the top and the bottom is a flip. And I will try to draw the flip. It's very hard. But it's in one case, you have three tetrahedra sharing one edge, and the other one's hiding in the back here. Maybe I'll put it in the front. There's three tetrahedra all sharing this middle edge. In the other case, you put them together, you glue them together, and then you pull them apart into two tetrahedra. Top and bottom. So it's instead of going from two triangles to two triangles, in 3D we go from three tetrahedra to two tetrahedra, or two to three. So it's not known. If you just take a point set in R3, and you look at all the triangulations, the tetrahedralizations of that point set, if they can all be connected by 2, 3, and 3, 2 flips. What this secondary polytope tells us is that the subset of regular triangulations is connected. And in fact, the same stuff works for triangulations at any dimension. Like, there's nothing special about 2D, right? In D dimensions, you're just going to take 1 over D times this. D plus 1. Okay, so it's, but what is known, which is perhaps surprising, is that if you take an arbitrary 3D triangulation and you try to flip your way to Delaunay in a greedy way, which is like the flip to Delaunay algorithm we saw, where you just find an edge, in this case you find a triangle that's not locally Delaunay, if it's not locally Delaunay, you try to flip it. In fact, this algorithm can get stuck. So the simple greedy thing does not work, but it's not known if something more clever does work. And pretty much, other than very special kinds of point sets, the regular triangulation, the connectivity of the flip graph for regular triangulations is all we know, even in 3D. It is, I should take it back, in like five dimensions, it's known that this graph is disconnected. You have five-dimensional triangulations that can't be flipped one to the other. But in 3D, it's still wide open. One of the major open questions in computational geometry, because these flip algorithms give us a way to do just purely local changes and worry about the global structure later, not worry about getting stuck. All right, any questions?
So they can't right now find a maximum minimum?
Well, the question is, what happens inside the secondary polytope? We know if you're walking around on the outside, your regular triangulation. But there's very little known about how to get to, if you're flipping around between triangulations which are not regular, which are not locally Delaunay, or weighted Delaunay. That's where things get complicated. Okay, see you next time.